Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks when she saw what she had done, gave her father 41.
Exactly.
Like that.
Welcome to the third episode of the Lizzie Borden Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Behrens. Lizzie Borden Podcast is a Nine Muses Books production. This is the only podcast devoted to Lizzie Borden and the Borden murders of 1892. Episode 3, A Lizzie Borden Primer. It seems timely to start this podcast as the 125th anniversary of the crime is coming up next year. The crime has been the subject of numerous books, plays, and movies in the last few years, most notably the Lifetime original movie Lizzie Borden Took an Axe, starring Christina Ricci, and the follow-up television series The Lizzie Borden Chronicles. There is now a new film in the works, starring Chloe Sevigny as Lizzie Borden and Kristen Stewart as Bridget Sullivan. The Lizzie Borden community is eagerly looking forward to this one. There are some great websites online where you could learn more about the historical Lizzie Borden and the Borden murders of 1892, including www.lizzieandrewborden.com, which is a portal site hosting the blog Mondo Lizzie, the Lizzie Borden Society Forum, a Lizzie Borden virtual crime museum, and the home of Pear Tree Press, which publishes many Lizzie Borden books, including my own first short story collection, Lizzie Borden Girl Detective. And don't forget to check out the excellent blog Warps and Wefts at LizzieBordenWarpsAndWefts.com. Much of this podcast series will be dealing with specific aspects of Lizzie Borden, so it seems appropriate to begin with a primer, a general overview that listeners can hear before delving into deeper, more obscure details of the life and times of Lizzie Borden. If you like this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes and leave a comment. You can also contact us directly at Lizzie@LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com. More information about the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series can be found at www.LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com, where you could sign up for our newsletter and read free Lizzie Borden Girl Detective stories. It's my intention to have future shows feature other unsolved murders of the Victorian age, as well as episodes exploring the lives of notorious and eccentric women, including Calamity Jane, Typhoid Mary, Victoria Woodhull, Carrie Nation, Sarah Winchester, and Emma Goldman, to name a few. But first, here's Lizzie Borden. In our last episode, we met Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century, published by Random House Children's Books, and available online. More information could be found at Sarah's website, sarahmillerbooks.com. Sarah was very agreeable to come back on the show and take part in what I call the Lizzie Borden Primer. This is a tour of the Lizzie Borden story, including her early life, the murders of 1892, for which she has become infamous, the investigation, the trial, and her acquittal, and the later part of Lizzie's life until her death in 1927. There is far too much information for one episode, so this will be split into three. But even then, we'll only be scratching the surface of this fascinating story that has captured our collective imagination for nearly 125 years. Okay, welcome to the Lizzie Borden Primer, and joining me today for this effort is Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. So welcome, Sarah. Welcome back to the program.
Hi. Glad to be here again.
Hi. Are you ready to give the complete round-the-world tour on Lizzie Borden in 45 minutes?
Lizzie Borden in 80 days? Yeah, sure.
In 80 minutes. So the listeners of this podcast, we can't assume that they know anything about Lizzie Borden, Fall River, or the Lizzie Borden murders outside of Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. So I'd like to present to them a very concise history, and we can go through it very fast. We're not going to get into a lot of detail. We're certainly not going to get into analysis, interpretation, or theories about the murders. We're just going to go quickly through the facts. And I wanted to start personally with a little bit of Fall River history, because I think an understanding of Fall River is crucial to an understanding of Lizzie Borden. And to put things in context, the area that Fall River is in was first populated by colonists back in the 1600s. The Mayflower landed in 1620. And that's when the Pilgrims established the Plymouth Colony. And the region of Massachusetts at that time was inhabited by a tribe of the Wampanoag Nation, who was ruled by the sachem Massasoit. Massasoit was the chief who celebrated the first Thanksgiving with the colonists. Now, the area known as Fall River was a bit further afield from Plymouth, but it was part of the area of the southeast coast, which was inhabited by Massasoit's tribe. So that landscape where Fall River is today was distinguished by a river that ran east-west into Mount Hope Bay, which had spectacular waterfalls. In fact, the name of the river, the Quickashon, derives from the Wampanoag word for falling water, hence Fall River.
Doesn't it flow right under the city?
The river is still there. It flows underneath I-195 and underneath the city hall. So the hostilities between the Plymouth colonists and the natives intensified during the course of the 17th century. And in 1675, Massasoit had passed on, and his son had died mysteriously while in the protective custody of the English. And as a result, war broke out. The resulting conflict was called King Philip's War. King Philip was Metacom, that was Massasoit's second son, who took on the name Philip. The war was savage. Entire English settlements were destroyed. A significant portion of the population on both sides were decimated. Unfortunately, in the aftermath, the Wampanoags were virtually wiped out. Metacom was hunted down and killed. Many of the Indian survivors were sold into slavery. It was very, very tragic. But it was an English veteran of this war, a man by the name of Colonel Benjamin Church, who first started exploiting the water power on the Quickashon River. And he built a sawmill, a gristmill, a fulling mill. So not only did Benjamin Church establish some of the first mills in the area, but he subsequently sold these mills to a family named Borden. And the Borden family then owned the water privileges along the Quickashon River. And this gave the colonial Borden family great power and eventually great wealth, especially with the rise of the cotton and the textile mills. So after the War of 1812, there was a huge industrial boom in America, and the Borden family prospered very well in the rise of textile in the area. And before long, there were great tycoons like Holder Borden, Spencer Borden, the brothers Richard and Jefferson Borden. And these men were some of the wealthiest men in Fall River in their day. They ran banks, they ran the Fall River line of steamships, they ran mills for iron, for textile. Now, Andrew Borden, that's Lizzie Borden's father, was prosperous in his own way. But of course, he was a carpenter, he was a furniture builder. He gradually built his wealth over time, but he never came near the fortunes of these other Bordens. At the time of the Borden murders in 1892, there had been Bordens in Fall River for over 200 years. The Borden family owned a lot of the land. I believe in your book you mentioned that there were essentially seven big families.
Yeah, I think Parallel Lives puts it as the seven family rule of Fall River.
The two big ones were, of course, the Bordens and the Durfees. And your book also indicates that there were, in 1892, 125 Borden families in Fall River at the time.
I think, 125 Borden families in the city directory. I believe, if I'm right, there was no larger producer of cotton cloth in the United States at that time than Fall River. It was known as Spindle City.
Andrew Borden was the son of a fishmonger, which right away shows you that he may have been on a branch of the family that wasn't as lucrative as some of the other branches. And he was trained as a carpenter. He had a furniture business with his partner, William Elmy. In various fictional accounts of the Borden murders, they show Andrew performing autopsies and doing embalmments.
And chopping the feet off of corpses to fit them into smaller, cheaper coffins.
Could you kind of poke a hole in that myth right now and say exactly what Andrew Borden was and who he was?
Yeah. Well, he was a carpenter. He built coffins. He became an undertaker, which at that time, my understanding, did not mean mortuary science of actually dealing with the bodies. It was more logistics, because he also sold furniture. He had, chairs. You could make folding chairs to people's houses, because that's where funerals happened. So they were bringing in seating. They were organizing things. They were providing just physical items that were necessary for funerals. And somebody suggested that just his bearing, he's a very dignified man, very sober looking. He was kind of suited for that work. He just fit the stereotype of the undertaker.
I don't think there's a picture of him smiling.
I don't know. None jumps to mind. He's not quite frowning, but he's just a very sober looking fellow.
Now, they lived, originally, the family did not live on 92 Second Street, which is where the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast is today. They lived down on Ferry Street. Street. They lived with his father, Abraham, and Andrew was married to a woman named Sarah Anthony Morse Borden. And in 1851, along comes Emma Lenora Borden, their first child. They did have a child after that.
There was a child that died in infancy. I think maybe her name was Alice. There's a little headstone in the cemetery at Oak Grove.
Correct. So that accounts for like a 9-year difference between Emma and Lizzie. Lizzie was born in 1860. But something tragic happened when Lizzie was very young.
Yeah, Lizzie was, what, about 3 years old, I want to say, when her mother died. If I recall correctly, the death certificate says uterine congestion 4 months, which some presume is a miscarriage, and also disease of spine, which I don't know what that refers to.
So she died when Lizzie was very young. Emma would have remembered the death, because Emma was 9 years older than Lizzie.
And Emma promised her mother to look after baby Lizzie, which becomes very significant much later.
Now, he was living with his extended family, so it's not like he was alone with the children, but he did remarry fairly quickly, within 2 years.
Yeah.
And he remarried to Abby Durfee Gray Borden.
She was about 37 at the time.
Which made her a spinster by that day's standards.
Yeah.
So they married during the Civil War. Even though the Civil War didn't reach Fall River, I mean, certainly people from Fall River went to fight in it and die in it. Young Lizzie may have had awareness of some of this, these events that were going on. And the little that we know about Lizzie's childhood, a lot of it was revealed in Parallel Lives, the book published by the Fall River Historical Society, Michael Martins and Dennis Binet. They give a list of Lizzie's childhood friends, what they thought of her, excerpts from their diaries. Were there any revelations from that material that stuck out for you?
There is a consensus that Lizzie was considered moody, is one way to put it. I believe her elementary school principal put it as subject to varying moods, which, you know, we're inclined to read quite a bit into nowadays, looking back on all that was happened. And it's difficult to know, was that significant or was she, you know, 12 and that happened? But there, it's not like there's just one person. There are, I want to say, at least two or three quoted directly as saying she was kind of moody, kind of melancholy. Yeah. Was a bit of maybe an indifferent pupil in school. I think she took music for quite some time, piano, and eventually kind of drifted away from that. And she did not actually ever finish school. She never graduated from high school.
To me, that's significant because there's always that myth that when her father died, he had on his finger a ring, her high school ring, and that showed some sort of affection between the two of them.
Yeah, and some people read a lot into that.
Yeah, my understanding, based on what Martins and Binet said in Parallel Lives, not only did Lizzie not finish high school, but at that time Fall River High School didn't give class rings, they gave pins. And they used pins in the 1870s, so that the ring on her father's finger may have come from Lizzie, but it certainly wasn't a class ring.
No, it was definitely not a class ring, but I think we can be reasonably sure that it did come from Lizzie if you trust Emma Borden's testimony at the trial, I believe, that came out. It was given to Mr. Borden by Lizzie. And the thing that people get a little weirded out by is that he did not wear a wedding ring, yet he did wear this little ring from his daughter.
So people who take the Andrew Borden abuse theory very seriously make a lot out of that.
Yes. That's a key factor for them in that theory.
Now, of course, the family moves to 92 Second Street in the early 1870s when Lizzie is a teenager. There's a lot of myths about that house as well, that it was barren, it was grim, there was no plumbing, there was no electricity, no heating, no bathrooms. But a revisionist way of thinking now is that the house really was quite comfortable for a middle-class family of their stature. Could you say a little bit about the house itself and how it differs from the house of horror myth that people have woven?
Yeah, the house itself, it's a very pleasant house. I've been in it. I've slept in it. Nice big windows. It seems quite sturdy to me. It has technically 5 bedrooms for 4 people. One of the bedrooms is used by Mr. and Mrs. Borden as a combination sort of little office dressing room. Mrs. Borden kept things in there. Mr. Borden kept his desk in there. There was a spare bedroom that Lizzie and Emma upstairs used to entertain their own guests privately. It's really not an unpleasant place, but it is. There's no way around it. It is far below what Mr. Borden could have afforded if he chose to. It was located very conveniently in a district of town that allowed him to walk to his various properties and business connections.
And it was a house that was also surrounded by places like there was a public stable on the street, there was a Chinese laundry.
Yeah, there's some restaurants, candy stores, yeah. Another little interesting thing about that house that I had to sort of put together because it's not spelled out, there's a a newspaper report by a woman who wheedled her way into the house after the crime to look at it. And she was surprised by how well decorated it was, and it was cozy and comfortable looking. She was amazed by Lizzie's bedroom, looking, you know, like any young lady's bedroom. But she specifically mentions the furniture in the room where Mrs. Borden was murdered being of a heavy, dark, gloomy style. And here's the key, that was in style about 20 years ago. Well, if you do the math, you realize that that was bought at the time of Andrew and Adam's marriage. He bought his new bride new furniture, which was in style at the time.
So Lizzie Borden belonged to a lot of societies through her congregational church, like the Christian Endeavor Society, the Fruit and Flower Mission, the Women Christians Temperance Union. She was active as a Sunday school teacher. It was a big surprise to me to find out that she taught Sunday school to Chinese immigrant children. I remember you and I were talking and we were speculating whether she was teaching Sunday school lessons or she was tutoring them in English.
Yeah, I need to clarify that. I think that might be a parallel lives question, because my impression, like most people, when you hear Sunday school, you think, you know, Bible stories and felt boards and crafts. But somewhere I picked up this idea that, in fact, she was actually teaching academic-type stuff to Chinese immigrants.
But it's undeniable that she was active in her community and active in her church.
And charity was something that she practiced, it seems, early on and was interested in. One of the newspaper interviews with her after she was arrested, that woman was involved with Lizzie in charity work and specifically mentioned her keeping the plates at the Thanksgiving, I think, dinner for newsboys and taking delight in their eager appetites.
So she was an active woman.
Yes.
The years did go by, though. She spent her 20s living at home, working with these societies, and as far as we know, never being courted by anyone, never having a relationship.
No, there's no evidence of that. And you have to wonder, does that have to do with her sort of no man's land position in society, with her father having a great deal of money, but living very conservatively, very modestly. So she's not in the hip part of town. She's kind of, you know, down in the, not quite the working class, you know, mill employee neighborhood. But like you said, you know, down the street from the Chinese laundry.
That's true. Yeah, the choice people up on the hill who would have been eligible brides did not live next door to a Chinese laundry or a livery stable.
And are those young men going to come down to Second Street in search of a proper bride?
Now, in 1890, she turns 30 years old, and she goes on a grand tour of Europe. One of the revelations of Parallel Lives was that we have her scrapbooks from that trip, with hundreds of pages in them, where she pasted all her postcards that she purchased on the trip. And she lovingly wrote captions and quotations. She quoted people like Shakespeare and her favorite bits of poetry underneath the pictures. This is a huge insight into her inner life.
Well, it's interesting, just the fact that it is an insight is very telling, because wouldn't most people do that? But because it's Lizzie Borden, we go, wow, because of the picture, the mental picture that we have of what Lizzie Borden means does not include the concept of, you know, really enjoying Italian art.
Maybe she enjoyed it too much, and when she came back to Fall River, she looked at the shabby town that she lived in and thought, this is not, you know, I wish I had some culture here.
Yeah, and there's speculation there, and that's about the time also that she and Emma switch bedrooms. Lizzie is suddenly, after many years, granted the larger bedroom of the pair that the two sisters shared, even though that Emma, as the eldest sister, presumably had first choice.
Yeah, and the woman who was nearly 40 years old goes to live in this tiny little room with one small window. We don't have any record anywhere of why they did this, how they felt about it.
Emma talks about it at the trial, but she's very almost sort of dismissive about it, just saying, well, I offered it to her, as if there was no reason whatsoever, which, I mean, it's possible. We don't know. But we want it to mean something, because we don't know what's going on.
Right. We're hypersensitive to every little disturbance in the force in that house.
And it is true that that room is significantly smaller. It is quite literally a bedroom. There's room for a bed and a nightstand, and you're done. Where Lizzie had room for, you know, had a little built-in bookcase kind of thing, and there's room for a little sofa, a dresser or two.
And the room that Emma swapped with Lizzie, the small room, there's also no privacy. I mean, to go anywhere, to leave it, you have to go through someone else's bedroom.
Right. Although when you're in it, you do have complete privacy because
that's true.
Lizzie's bedroom, what became Lizzie's bedroom at the time of the crime, Lizzie's bedroom is a passage. So if you're Lizzie, there's always the chance that your sister is going to want to come or go, which means she's going to walk right through your bedroom. Where when I was there alone, I was thinking, boy, if I get really creeped out, I can barricade myself in Emma's room because I know there's only one door.
Yeah, that's where the phantasms can't get you. So it's really like Lizzie was living in Emma's dressing closet. That's what it basically felt like. So in the year leading up to the tragedy, there were a couple of events that occurred that were made into a big deal later on when people thought Lizzie had murdered her father and stepmother. Two of them that I indicated here was a burglary and the incident with the pigeons. So if you can quickly describe both of them, starting with the burglary, tell us what happened and why it's significant in evaluating Lizzie Borden's guilt or innocence.
I want to say about a year or so prior to the murder, Andrew Borden reported to the Fall River Police that his home had been broken into during the day. The maid, Bridget Sullivan, was home. Lizzie was home. Emma was home. The elder Bordens were not home. And this person allegedly snuck in the back door, presumably, up the back steps, which is how you must access the master bedroom in that house, is up the back steps, because the connecting door between Lizzie's room and her parents' room was perpetually locked from both sides. And once in that room, this person also broke into the little dressing room that Mr. Borden used for his desk. His safe was in there. And Mrs. Borden also kept some things in there and made off with Mrs. Borden's gold watch. I'm going to say $20, $25 in gold, maybe some cash, and some horse car tickets, which turned out to be significant because Mr. Borden was on the board of that company and his tickets were a perk, so they were specially marked. So in theory, if those tickets turned up, if they alerted the conductors to the streetcar to look for these tickets that had been stolen, they should have been able to track back who had those tickets, who presented them. Rumors would rise up later that it was friends of Lizzie Borden who were presenting these tickets for a free ride, but that has never been substantiated. I think there was a nail found in the keyhole, which Lizzie herself pointed out and presented to the inspector. So there's speculation that it was Lizzie who did it.
After this event, Mr. Borden kind of went crazy with the home security. He put in extra locks. He started locking his bedroom door, and he did a very curious thing with the key to his bedroom door. He would lock his bedroom door when he left, unlock it when he entered, but he would take the key, and after coming downstairs in the morning, he would place it on the sitting room mantelpiece.
Which is like, if you're concerned about security, why are you doing that? It is weird. Some people think that's like a jab at Lizzie saying, yeah, I know who really did this. But then why would you leave it there for it to happen again? If you were truly concerned about your daughter being a security problem, I don't think he would do that, but I'm not Mr. Borden. I don't know what he was thinking. Well, and you know, the funny thing is, too, that Lizzie also locked her bedroom when she came and went, because she told the police, nobody can get in here because I always lock it when I go out. How Emma managed around that, I don't know. Presumably Emma had a key, too.
That's true. If Lizzie locked her door, she must be referring to the door that leads out onto the hallway, the top of the stairs, which means Emma's locked out of her room as well.
But I can also tell you, in my own house, which was built in 1873, there are not key locks, but little sort of deadbolt type things on the bedroom doors. They're small, but they exist. So it's not completely strange that the locks existed. The manner in which they use them in the Borden house still does strike us as kind of odd. But in a home of that era, to have locks on the bedroom doors was not out of the ordinary.
And they were in the center of town. I mean, the neighborhood they were in was so populated that there were street vendors right outside their house every day. That's why there's a couple of vendors who testified as to, you know, people who they saw on the street at the time of the murders, etc. But the question remains of whether they were locking their doors inside the house to prevent violation from each other. That's a cynical thought that some people make a big deal out of. And then after the burglary, several months before the murders, there was the incident of the pigeons in the barn. Could you explain that?
Yeah. There had been a break-in in the barn as well, and that was sort of brushed off to a certain extent. Somebody, maybe it was Lizzie's friend, Alice Russell, saying that was probably boys, and they were just after pigeons. And after that break-in, Mr. Borden did slaughter the pigeons that were in the barn. Now, there's a myth that rises out of that that says those pigeons were Lizzie's pets, and he did it to punish her. And the myth further specifies that he beheaded them with a hatchet, which would, of course, then become the murder weapon eventually in this big circle of justice. But there is, in fact, no evidence that those were Lizzie's pets. They were probably kept as livestock to be eaten as squab on the Borden family dinner table.
And Lizzie did testify that her father wrung their necks. There was nothing in her testimony that said she was emotionally disturbed by any of this. But in the TV movie, they show Lizzie practically having a meltdown, going, "They're my pigeons.
Yeah, and it is a fact that she was very sensitive to animals and their treatment, but you know, they also, people raise animals to eat them. They did. We still do. We just, you know, pretend we don't.
And so the incident with the pigeons was brought out by people who kind of were predisposed towards seeing Lizzie as being guilty and being somehow abused by her father, that the violence against the pigeons was some sort of paternal abuse against Lizzie herself.
And there's no evidence to suggest what type of behavior on Lizzie's part might have triggered this punishment from her father. So it's just very murky.
There was an issue with the house around the corner, the Whitehead house. Could you explain that?
Yes. Mrs. Borden, Mr. Borden's second wife, who is, of course, Lizzie's stepmother, had a very, very much younger half-sister that she loved her basically as a daughter. I believe they were 30-some years apart. So Mrs. Borden was old enough to be this woman's mother. And she spent a lot of time at that house, going over there and being sociable and friendly and trying to, they weren't very well off, this Whitehead family. That family lived in a duplex, we would say, out here near Detroit. I guess out east, the term is a double house. The other half of the house was occupied by Mrs. Borden's stepmother, who decided that she wanted to move out. And that meant that the whole house was going to go up for sale because Mrs. Borden's half-sister could not afford to buy either her half or her mother's half. So Mr. Borden, for reasons not entirely clear to us, except maybe to be kind to his wife, bought the house and deeded it to Abby, which meant that her dearest relative would be secure. She had a place to live. But it just seems to have inflamed Lizzie and Emma that he would spend, I want to say, was it $5,000 for that house? So they were very troubled by this and felt that it was unfair. And Lizzie is, I believe, quoted, she may have said this herself in her own testimony, that she said either to Mr. or Mrs. Borden, what he did for her people, he ought to do for his own people. So Mr. Borden was a very fair man. Some think maybe a little too black and white rigid fairness, but in fairness to his daughters who were upset, he deeded them his father's old house on Ferry Street, which was of equal value. And the sisters then collected rent on that property for the next several years until just a matter of weeks before the murder. They decided, for reasons unknown to us, that they didn't care to be proprietors of that property anymore. And Mr. Borden bought it from them, didn't just take it over. He paid them $5,000 for it shortly before he died.
Yeah, which is certainly not a sign of stinginess or abuse.
No. But it is that very rigid, down-to-the-penny fairness that Mr. Borden was well-known in town for.
You know, I'm sure there was some reflection of his business stinginess in his personal life, but it may not have been as exaggerated or as dangerously abusive as people make it out to be.
Well, I believe he had a falling out with his sister's husband. Hiram Harrington had cut his acquaintance, was how Mr. Harrington himself put it, over an exchange of property. And Mr. Borden, I think, insisted that his sister pay the utility bill. It was some very small amount. And it felt just nitpicky, is the impression that I get. That, you know, we did this big business deal, but you want me to pay, I'm making this up, $1.75 for the water bill? Yeah, he did, because he was fair down to the last penny. But to Hiram Harrington, that was just the last straw.
Right, and Harrington did say some nasty things about Lizzie in the days after the murders.
Harrington almost appears to me to be, if not the first, one of the very earliest sources for the Lizzie Borden caricature myth.
Yeah, that was just literally after the murders, right? Just within a day or two?
Yeah, just within a day or two, yeah.
The day before the murders, members of the family start coming down with food poisoning. And at 8 o'clock in the morning, Abby Borden runs out of their house, crosses the street to where Dr. Bowen lives. Dr. Bowen is one of their local doctors. And she bangs on the door and starts saying, you know, somebody is poisoning us. She's convinced, I believe she thought it was the milk. Somebody is poisoning the milk. And then as she's talking to Dr. Bowen, who's trying to calm her down, Andrew comes out of their house, crosses the street, and yells at Abby to come back. I think it's rumored that he said to her, that man's not getting any of my money.
That is close to what Alice Russell relays in her testimony about Lizzie's visits to her home that same night, Wednesday evening, the 3rd of August.
Right.
As she recalled it, Mrs. Borden did go across the street. It kind of worked up. Bowen said hysterical, near hysterical. He thought she was going to be sick in his office. And he kind of calmed her down and sort of patted her head, you know, and said, oh, go on home. It's the summer complaint. But he did apparently stop in at the Borden home a few hours later or something and wanted, you know, offering help, medicine, whatever, you know, are you feeling all right? How's it going? Just being a sort of combination of neighbor and doctor, because they were just kitty corner from each other. And according to Alice Russell, that's when Mr. Borden was rude to Dr. Bowen and said, get on out of here.
I see.
No more of my money for you.
It could be that the family was poisoned or had food poisoning. There's always that possibility that someone was doing it to them. But popular legend attributes it to a very infamous batch of mutton that the family was eating during those days. But there's a controversy over how much mutton, when it was served. What do you know about that?
My best source for information about the mutton comes from the maid, Bridget Sullivan, who was, of course, responsible for preparing the meals. And her testimony indicates that the mutton did not debut on the Borden table until Wednesday. So the day after they had been sick in the night. They were sick Tuesday evening, the 2nd. And Wednesday, I think I don't remember if it was for lunch or for supper. That's when the mutton arrived on the dinner table. So the mutton cannot be, according to Bridget, if you believe her, cannot be the culprit for that food poisoning.
That would have been after Abby Borden's visit across the street with whatever cramp she was experiencing or nausea.
What they did have the night before was swordfish. So maybe they got some bad fish. I don't know. But according to Bridget, that's the progression. They had, I think, pork steaks for breakfast on Wednesday morning, followed by mutton. And then Thursday morning, the infamous Borden breakfast. It includes cold mutton and mutton broth and Johnny cakes and bananas and just kind of an odd assortment of stuff.
But that mutton would have only been recycled once then.
Yes.
Whereas in the popular legend, they made every mutton stew, mutton broth, mutton cuts, you know, like one leg of mutton lasted 5 days.
Yeah, it sounds like it's week old mutton by the time Thursday morning rolls around. And, you know, people jokingly say that, well, no wonder Lizzie murdered him. It was August. She was wearing a corset and she had to eat that mutton for the 7th day in a row.
Right. My favorite moment in the Elizabeth Montgomery movie is when they're serving that meal and he lifts up the top of the tureen and the camera looks in and there's rancid mutton with flies buzzing around it inside. and Lizzie looks sick looking at it. And Andrew goes, waste not, want not. I mean, that's totally the legend, right there.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, there's always that tiny grain of truth because Mr. Borden seems to have been very much a waste not, want not man. You know, he'd wear a tie until it was threadbare.
But the reality is the mutton was only recycled once.
Yes. And, you know, they had an ice box. The ice came that morning. So, you know, the odds of it being spoiled, it's certainly not impossible. It was August. It was the 1890s. It appears that they took every precaution that was available to them to prevent food poisoning.
Now we come to August 3rd, 1892. This is the morning that Abby Borden becomes very ill, runs across the street to see Dr. Bowen. The mutton is served later that day, so that may not have, almost certainly wasn't the culprit for everyone feeling nauseous. But something else happens that afternoon. Very curious incident in a drugstore up South Main Street. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes. I don't recall the name of the drugstore off the top of my head, but there was a man working behind the counter whose name was Eli Bentz. And Mr. Bentz clearly recalled a woman who he knew as Miss Borden. And I'm very persnickety about this, maybe to a fault. But again, this is a city where there are 125 Borden families. He himself did not identify her as Lizzie Borden. But this woman he knew as a Borden, a young woman, came in and asked for a certain amount of prussic acid, which was not available without a prescription. And he informed her so. And she was displeased and said that, well, she had been able to get it before and that she wanted to use it to dust around the edges of a sealskin cape to keep vermin from the fur. And he says something like, well, my good woman, you know, we're not going to provide that for you. So away she goes. And it was another man in the store at the time who identified her as Lizzie Borden. Whether or not that man was correct, we don't know. After the murder happened, Eli Bence was uneasy about what he believed he had seen was, to, in his mind, that was Lizzie Borden, who had come to his store and asked for a deadly poison. So he reported that to the police. And the police took him over to the Borden home on the evening of August 4th, which is the evening of the murder. And he stood in a hallway while a police officer spoke with Lizzie in the kitchen. We don't know if Lizzie was aware that Mr. Bence was in her house. Mr. Bence did not speak to her. I don't know if he saw her. He was there to listen to her. So the police officer got her talking, and Eli Bence recognized her voice as a match with the woman that he had spoken with in his shop the day before.
Now, the prussic acid, which is what the woman who entered the shop allegedly tried to purchase, is an odorless, colorless, tasteless, highly poisonous substance. It was a controlled substance at the time, and it was also a favorite murder weapon of Victorian lady husband killers. So that this increases the suspicion. Now, there's a lot of talk about what could have been going on in her head if it actually was Lizzie Borden. It could be something as simple as she had sealskin capes and she wanted to clean them with the prussic acid. It could have been that she saw her family being very ill and she thought that poisoning them at that time would have made things less suspicious. So what do you think of that?
I don't know. I tend to, like I said, I'm so persnickety about the details of what exactly Eli Bence claimed and did not claim because I don't believe him. I think he would. I believe that he believed himself. I don't think he was lying. I think he honestly thought that Lizzie Borden had come to his business and asked for poison. I believe he was wrong. There was, at the time, also a sting going on in Fall River.
A sting operation?
Yeah. A state inspector's wife was going into drugstores and asking for substances that should not be dispensed without a prescription to see if those substances would be provided. And it was alleged by Lizzie's friends that this woman resembled Lizzie Borden. To me, it's not just because of what I think of Lizzie Borden myself. I think there's enough reasonable doubt. I think it's quite possible that Mr. Bence was mistaken.
Well, Sarah, we're going to take a quick break now. You've been listening to the Lizzie Borden podcast. We've been talking to Sarah Miller, author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. We have more of the Lizzie Borden Primer with Sarah Miller coming up, but first, a quick word about Nine Muses Books.
Nine Muses Books is proud to sponsor the Lizzie Borden podcast. Nine Muses Books is an independent press featuring the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series written by author Richard Behrens. These well-crafted comic mysteries set a fictionalized Lizzie as a teenage detective against a real Victorian-era Fall River, Massachusetts. The characters are remarkably vivid. The narrative is intellectually stimulating, and as one critic has described it, author Richard Behrens really knows how to toss delightfully deceptive literary curveballs that keep the reader mystified until just that penultimate perfect moment. Michael Martins of the Fall River Historical Society has called these stories a must-read for all those intrigued by Fall River history, mystery, and, of course, Lizzie Borden. Shelley Dezik of the Lizzie Borden Warps and Wefts blog has written that the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective stories are so much fun, it's nearly criminal. The Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mysteries can be found on Amazon in ebook format, and most books are offered as free downloads. In addition to these short stories, there is also the full-length novel, The Minuscule Monk, offered in both print book and ebook formats. When a dead body mysteriously appears in the basement of her father's furniture store, 15-year-old Lizzie Andrew Borden takes on the case. Accompanied by an eccentric millionaire who campaigns to extend the vote to animals, a Boston Terrier trained to sniff out crooked politicians, and a boy detective who believes that the entire universe is inside his own head, Lizzie follows a trail of taxidermy tools and Civil War bushwhackers to the Minuscule Monk, a legendary gunslinger whose mummified body will bring a punter's pot to anyone who can deliver it to the New York gangster who has been hunting the monk for decades. With such high stakes, everyone has a motive for murder, yet everyone seems innocent. History and mystery fans alike will find The Minuscule Monk a thoroughly engaging read. For more information, go to LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com and sign up for our newsletter. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, and listen to our podcasts on iTunes. Visit the Garden Bay Films channel on YouTube to see special visual editions of the podcast as well as the Lizzie miniseries. And now, back to the Lizzie Borden podcast.
Right. So we've been talking about the odd events on the day before the murders, August 3rd, 1892. And we had the case of food poisoning where the Borden family was starting to suffer the effects of what may have been food poisoning. We had Eli Bence, who was a pharmacist down on South Main Street, testified that a woman who he believed to be Lizzie Borden came into his place of business and tried to purchase a toxic substance, that prussic acid, which possibly could have been a murder weapon. Also that afternoon, a man comes into town. By urban legend, he possessed only the clothes on his back, did not even have a toothbrush. This is Uncle John, John Vinnicum Morse. Could you say something about who Uncle John was and where he, what role he plays in this ongoing soap opera?
Uncle John was Lizzie and Emma's uncle on their mother's side. It was their mother's brother. It would have been Andrew Borden's brother-in-law. And he, it sounds like he and Andrew Borden got along fairly well, even though after the death of Sarah Morse Borden, they were not really quite as related as they used to be, but they maintained a friendship. It seems like they had similar views about business and so forth. And so he would visit from time to time. He'd kept up with the family. And yeah, he just shows up. And I think even by his own testimony, if I recall correctly, he may have been asked in court about a toothbrush. And he said, nope. Like, he just showed up at the door, like, hey, guys, here I am, having a visit. And he spent the night in the spare room where, you know, spoilers, Abby Borden will be found dead tomorrow morning. He had been a butcher. He was referred to in the newspapers as a horse trader, but that was kind of a sort of a derogatory kind of an occupation at that time. So I don't know if that was quite correct. If I recall correctly, he lived in Iowa and came back from time to time to do business.
He spent many years out west. That's true.
Yeah, he had a farm. Yeah.
So he was either a man who didn't brush his teeth or he was a crazy murderer, either one.
Well, you know, when you look at his picture, you could believe that maybe he was a crazy murderer. He had those sort of prominent bulging eyes. He had a big old beard. You know, it's not a big stretch in terms of just the way he looks to imagine him possibly, and knowing that he had been a butcher, wielding an axe.
Now, the Morse family, as you said yourself, was related to Sarah Anthony Morse Borden, who was Lizzie Borden's biological mother. The pictures of the two of them, you could tell the family resemblance.
Oh, yeah.
There's a very strong family resemblance. You can see a little bit of that in Lizzie as well.
Yeah, that sort of that gaze that Lizzie is kind of infamous for that tends to unnerve people. She tended to engage her eyes, her gaze with the camera, which was not the fashion at the time. But Uncle John does it. Her mother does it. Emma didn't. Emma was more demure looking. But we look at people like Lizzie and Uncle John, their images make us go, oh, there's something different about those people. And there is. They're engaging with the camera in a different way than we're accustomed to.
Now, Uncle John appears in town. This is seen as highly suspicious by some people who investigate the case. I do believe that it was a simple matter of Andrew Borden made a request for him to come over to do some business or negotiate some trade with some horses on his farm out in Swansea.
Yeah, and we forget, I think, also in our time where we can plan right down to the minute and be, you know, with cell phones and whatnot, even be making plans as the minutes pass, where back when it was like, you know, can you come out? You're dealing with, you know, train schedules and all sorts of other things that are not solid, and you can't get word to somebody quickly if your plans change. So it may have been a more loosey-goosey kind of thing, like, hey, could you come out? Yeah, I'll be there when I can. But, you know, it's not like meeting somebody at the gate at the airport.
Correct.
You just don't have that ability to have that kind of precision. So who knows?
Now, Uncle John comes out he does go out on a buggy and he goes to visit the farm out in Swansea on the afternoon of the 3rd. One other peculiar thing that happens that day is that Lizzie Borden leaves the house in the evening, I believe around 7 o'clock, and she goes around the corner to visit her friend Alice Russell. Lizzie is in a very disturbed state, and Alice is very surprised to see her, and Lizzie says a whole bunch of stuff to her that seemed a little crazy at the time.
Yeah, and it seems, in retrospect, if you're of the opinion that Lizzie was guilty, it sounds very much as if she's sort of laying out all suspicion so that maybe suspicion will fall elsewhere. She's talking about her father having an enemy, being uneasy at home. There was a quote, something to the effect of, as if they will burn the house down around us. She wants to sleep with one eye open. She talks about her parents feeling unwell and being sick, and is the bread poisoned? Is the milk poisoned? Yeah, she's throwing a lot of stuff out there. So either she was genuinely very afraid and sort of, you know, like you said, disturbed by it, or she's just laying all kinds of, you know, little mines under the surface so that the next day all this stuff can detonate and appear to put someone else under suspicion. She talks about, for example, seeing a man, I think, dashing around the back corner of the house as she came home one evening to let herself in the back door. A lot of vague, unsettling stuff that makes it sound as if the family is being targeted for some kind of ill will or, you know, possibly crime.
Yeah, and on the evening right before the murders, Lizzie Borden is around the corner hysterically telling her friend that someone is trying to hurt them.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
If she's guilty, her behavior at Alice Russell's house either points towards a cold, calculating plan, or it just points to totally psychotic behavior.
Or somebody who is overwhelmingly clumsy about, I mean, to lay out all those possibilities is goofy. I mean, if I was going to chop my parents up and lay suspicion around, I think I would maybe stick with just one thing instead of, I mean, she lays out like three or four possibilities. It's poison, fire, you know, strange.
And she was not asked about any of this at the inquest. So we only have Alice Russell's testimony. We don't have anything from Lizzie Borden's own words that she had these thoughts, that someone was trying to hurt her family. She never had an opportunity to explain herself.
When she was asked at the inquest, was there anybody, was there an enemy of your father, anybody your father had trouble with? She says, I think initially she says no. And then she mentions one name, which is another uncle, Hiram Harrington. But that, I mean, it's completely unrelated to everything she just said to Alice Russell a few days prior.
So Lizzie leaves Alice Russell's house and she arrives back home late at night. And she comes in through the front door of the house and she does a very peculiar thing. Uncle John is in the sitting room with Andrew Borden, presumably Abby Borden as well. And we must mention that Emma herself is off visiting friends in Fairhaven, so she has a complete airtight alibi. But here we have Uncle John, Abby Borden, Andrew Borden sitting in the sitting room while Lizzie comes home from Alice Russell's house. And they kind of half expect Lizzie to come in and say hello, but she doesn't do that. She, without saying a word to anybody, she goes up the front stairs, disappears into her room and shuts the door and also presumably locks it.
Yeah, as was her custom, to lock her door for sure. And it's not clear to me, do we expect Lizzie to say hello to everybody or do they actually expect Lizzie to come in and say hello? But we certainly have that expectation that, you know, you come in and you, now she may not have been aware that Uncle John was there. I don't know. Do we know that? Do we know if she knew Uncle John was in the house? Because certainly when you walk in that front door, you can see there's a very clear sight line through the couch and the kitchen door beyond. If anybody was sitting in the chairs alongside the windows on that south side of the house, you would not be able to see them just from the foyer. So, yeah, it definitely feels weird to us. What the family was accustomed to and what their expectations were, I think, is not clear. But, yeah, it's not even a, hey, go on to bed, see you in the morning.
Right.
Nothing at all.
Right. Or, hi, Uncle John, haven't seen you in 2 years.
Right. Or, oh, I'm not feeling well, going upstairs, sorry, nothing.
So Lizzie Borden goes upstairs to go to sleep. Presumably Andrew and Abby follow shortly after. Uncle John goes up to the guest room, which is right next door to Lizzie's bedroom. And they all go to bed. The night closes in and everyone's asleep. And with that, we're going to leave our listeners hanging. They want to hear the good stuff. They want to hear the murder.
They don't need that now.
They want to hear the hatchet swinging. But we're going to have to take a break. We're going to have to end this episode. And next time on the Lizzie Borden podcast, we're going to continue talking with Sarah Miller, author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. And she's going to chat with us about the day of the murders and the subsequent investigation and the trial. So join us next time on the Lizzie Borden podcast. Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Lizzie Borden podcast. I'm your host, Richard Behrens. This podcast was written and produced by Nine Muses Books and engineered by Mason Amadeus. The theme music was composed and performed by Melora Krieger. The Lizzie Borden podcast is sponsored by Nine Muses Books and the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series. More information can be found at www.lizziebordenpodcast.com and www.lizziebordengirldetective.com.